Welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines. I'm your host, Daniel Angernon. If you're tuning in live, then it's New Year's Day 2013. I hope you have all had fun and safe holiday celebrations. Or not celebrations, that's cool too. And if you're in Ontario and listening to this live, then I hope you're on your way to the Marineland Animal Defense Operation Shut It Down launch, which will be taking place at noon at Marineland. It's the first big demo of the year. Last year saw great success, and I hope that it will continue into the new season. And hopefully this will be the last demo, and it'll be shut down before it even opens. Today we'll be looking back on the past year on Animal Voices, and I'll be featuring a selection of some of the great interviews that we've had on the show in 2012. This summer, Aaron O'Sullivan and I have been excited to add our current duties as audio technician and producer and host a few shows, and it has been a really rewarding experience. I hope that you've enjoyed the interviews we've put together. Right around this time, I had been lucky enough to meet Shannon Mann in Calgary and was not only thrilled to become the friend of such a kind, thoughtful, and interesting person, but also delighted that she was willing to sit down with me and talk about her work. Here's a clip from my interview with Shannon Mann. You mentioned earlier that one of the things that drew you to it was the sense of adventure and danger. If we could touch on that for a minute, as like I've seen on Whale Wars, and as I've been talking to you, you can attest to it, there is definite danger that comes with going and effectively sabotaging and stopping ships from killing animals. So there's this culture of violence because these fishers, hunters, they seem to be disregarding the lives of the activists just as much as the whales, sharks, seals, etc., that they're hunting. Can you comment on that? Like, what have you seen in regards to how they've treated you?
Well, I mean,
and your crewmates.
Their motivation is profit. Mm-hmm. But the danger with Sea Shepherd, although I think we do an amazing job at mitigating the risks, is every time you go to sea, and especially when you hit those, you know, the roaring 40s and furious 50s, they're is an element of danger just in that, just in being at sea. But then when you face an opponent like, for instance, the Japanese whaling fleet, who has endless supply of funds, it seems, and a huge motivation to kill whales, their concern is not about our safety.
No.
Their primary concern is stopping us from stopping them.
Yeah.
And every year, honestly, every year, it seems that they get more and more violent. This year we've had a few crew members injured by crew members on the harpoon ships.
Yeah.
In my experience, from the first time I went down to the Antarctic, the whaling fleet seemed to be scared of us. I think they didn't know what to expect, and they thought there was these crazy activists on board, and they didn't know what we were going to do. And then over the years, they have just done more and more and become more and more aggressive and violent towards us. We've had flashbang grenades thrown at us. My gosh, this year we are so fortunate that they actually didn't kill some of the crew members on board. They were throwing huge grappling hooks into the small boats and then ripping them up via like a pulley system on their decks. So one of the grappling hooks landed in the seat that there was actually a crew member in, and it cut the seat in the delta and then the edge of the small boat and ripped that all to shreds. It is absolutely, I don't know, a stroke of some kind of intervention that crew member didn't get impaled and hauled up on that hook.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm sort of at a loss from that.
It can be pretty scary. But again, like, we have to be sure that we don't injure a single one of their crew members.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you probably saw too, the Audie Gill was run over by the Shonan Maru a few years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
And the problem as well is that it is Wild West in the Southern Ocean. There's no one to turn to really to kind of uphold international seafaring laws.
Which I'm guessing is partially why you guys are there, because someone's got to protect the whales. And actually, that was leading into what I was going to ask next. What are government responses that you see? Because I'm guessing not many people are on your side.
You know, I think the government of Australia faces quite a challenge, because I think the Australian government is in quite the conundrum, because their population is hugely supportive of Sea Shepherd. They love their whales. They have the whale watching, the humpbacks. But the government, we put them in such a difficult position, because you know, it's about economics and politics and trade with Japan. So they don't want to help us, and they actually in the past have denied visas to crew members. And at one point they didn't want to allow our ship in port, but because of the public outcry, as soon as Paul goes to the media with that, everything gets reversed. Oh no, there was a glitch. Yeah, your crew members are welcome. But you're right too. It shouldn't really be us that's going down there to stop the whaling fleet from killing whales in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. This is the responsibility of governments across the world, but nobody has the guts to do it. Nobody has, I guess, nobody feels inclined to battle the Japanese government because of trade.
And the Sea Shepherd's new campaign, Zero Tolerance, is currently just started. It's underway. And if you're interested to learn more, be sure to check them out and find out what they're doing to stop illegal whaling and fishing. Of course, Erin has had her fair share of really cool interviews this year as well. One really powerful episode I found was with Jenny Brown from the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary, who's also written the book The Lucky Ones. So let's have a listen.
Now, in your book, you do refer to some of your animals coming from factory farms, but there's also a lot of them that are coming from small-scale farms. And small-scale farms, as we know, are now being sort of touted as a more humane alternative to the factory farm. Now, I grew up in a community of small farms, so I know firsthand the abuses that animals in these situations suffer. And a lot of times, it's at the hands of very good people who simply don't know any better. And this is why the move to allow, for example, backyard chickens, that's a big thing going on in Ottawa, where I live right now, that really scares me. Can you speak from your experience about this idea that when it comes to farming, small equals humane?
Yeah, and I talk a lot about that in the book, which, by the way, is called The Lucky Ones, My Passionate Fight for Farm Animals, and it just came out. And it chronicles the story of my life with a lot of this information about the myths of humane agriculture. First of all, the term humane slaughter is an oxymoron. It's basically saying humane murder, humane killing. Those two words should never go together. Also, what people realize, especially starting with this backyard farming movement, what people don't realize is that these people are mail ordering chicks from these large hatcheries that have catalogs, and you can pick out whatever kind of breed you want and the productive egg layers or the birds that are like Frankenbirds that grow to market weight at 45 days of age. It depends on where your feelings and your idea of what is humane. But again, in the example of chickens, all these tiny chicks are mail ordered for small farms alike, and at the hatcheries for the egg-laying breeds, the males are skinny little worthless animals to them because they're in this country and pretty much around the world in Western civilization, there are birds that are used commercially for egg-laying, there are birds that are used commercially for meat, and there's very little crossover. So the productive layers from the hatcheries, they sort out all the males and they're ground up alive or they're put into large plastic bags. And when they're full, they're tied up. Also, a lot of those chicks are de-beaked because they're not determining if they're going to go to a small farm or to a factory farm. They're expected to be crowded no matter where they live. And so often at about 10 days old, the females have their beaks seared off with a hot guillotine blade or pressed up against a molten hot surface so that the tips of their beaks become round, not pointed. If they're packed in together, they're not going to peck or cannibalize one another. So these chicks never meet their mother. They're mail ordered. They're literally shipped through the mail. You know, the hatcheries say, don't worry about counting the dead ones. We'll replace them. And when their production declines, they're usually sent off to slaughter as well. Well, let's rephrase that. They're always sent off to slaughter unless it's somebody they've mail ordered for chickens and they're eating their eggs. Perhaps they're going to let them live for the rest of their lives, but they're certainly not going to be most people take them to the vet and love them and care for them and have the knowledge about how to treat their parasites and external lice and things like that. But in the end, anybody that's doing it for profit, there is no retirement home for the spent layers when their production declines. They all become the cheap chicken meat that's in soups, dog and cat food, that sort of thing. So is that humane? Look at what happens before they even come to these small farmers. The fact that they're grinding up alive all the males. Are you okay with that? I'm not. In terms of like free range pigs, they're still castrated without anesthesia. Their tails are cut off without anesthesia. Oftentimes for the males, their incisor teeth are pulled. Their ears are notched. This is all without painkillers or anesthesia. Is that humane to you? The last example, organic milk or beef from grass-fed animals. Still, these are animals that are not being pampered, given pain meds and anesthesia when they're castrated, in the example of beef cows, and they're branded. They're often dehorned. For dairy cows, no matter what, for any farm that's producing milk that's in the business of the dairy industry, they impregnate those cows by artificial insemination year after year. And just like in the chicken industry, there are breeds we use for milk production and there are breeds we use for beef, and there's very little crossover. So when dairy cows, when they're about 13 months old, they're artificially inseminated, and their gestation period is like ours. It's 9 months. And year after year, she has her calves taken away from her, typically within a day or two of birth. And these animals are not automatrons. They cry and they bellow and their hearts are broken and they'll bellow for days looking aimlessly for their calves. So is that humane? I don't think so. And at 5 years of age, instead of living to 20 or 25 years old, dairy cows are forced to produce 10 times more milk than they would have in nature, often through growth hormones, but also through the constant pregnancy and being milked during pregnancy and the toll that takes on their bodies. And at about 4 or 5 years of age, typically the calcium's been leached from her bones. They get very brittle bones. 65% of dairy cows suffer from painful mastitis, which is an infection in their breast. And in the end, you know, 85% of the ground beef or hamburger meat is made from the spent bodies of dairy cows. So look into it. A lot of people think that cows just magically produce milk, but just as any mother, they have maternal instincts and nurturing, and calves will stay with their mothers for years and years, maybe the rest of their life if they're allowed to. There's a maternal bond there. Siblings want to be together. Take, for instance, Judy and Patsy, the pigs out there. They're inseparable. They have familial ties. They recognize their families. They recognize their friends. Are you okay with that? Would you be okay with pulling puppies away from a mama dog at a day of age? But then really look at the big picture. Humans are the only species that drinks milk into adulthood. We're the only species that drinks the mammary secretions of another species. Why don't we drink kangaroo milk or rat milk or dog milk? Because cows produce a lot of milk and they're easily controlled. And that's sort of what our bankrupt society, our bankrupt humanity looks to do.
Aaron also interviewed Morgan Lance from Animals Asia. The work of Animals Asia has been extremely important in the fight to ban bear bile farming and move those bears to sanctuary, but unfortunately faces eviction threats in Vietnam. Here's Aaron with some of that interview now. And be sure to check out the current Animals Asia campaign and find out how you can help support them and keep those bears safe.
So tell us about the eviction.
Yes, the eviction. Our Vietnam sanctuary, which has been in operation since 2005 and was formed in partnership with a branch of the Vietnamese government, the Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Development, and was also given the official seal of approval by the Prime Minister of Vietnam in 2008, is currently under threat of eviction. And the reason is that the sanctuary is located in the Tam Dao National Park, and the park director, Mr. Tien, has launched a very aggressive campaign to remove us from that location. He initially had tried to stop us from building more bear houses and enclosures in our sanctuary, bear houses and enclosures that are desperately needed if we're going to be able to get more bears off of farms in Vietnam. I should say that right now we estimate that about 2,400 bears are on biofarms in Vietnam. And again, we only have 104 bears at our sanctuary, so there's plenty more work to be done. But we're at maximum capacity at the moment. We need to build more and had been given the approval to build more by the local government partners. But Mr. Tien, the park director, would like to have us removed from the land, we believe, because a company that his daughter has an investment in is interested in building hotels and a tourist park on the property. And what has happened is that he has lobbied the Ministry of Defense to declare the park land that we are situated on an area of national defense significance. So this, of course, has caused us a problem and has resulted in the military asking us to officially leave, basically giving us an eviction notice. The notice has now gone to the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister will make the ultimate decision as to whether we must leave or not. Some interesting things that have come up are that after the eviction notice was put through, just right after that, actually, Park Director Mr. Tien put through his own submission of an application for development of a wildlife park in the same area where our sanctuary is currently located, the same area that had just been declared, you know, of national defense significance. So again, we really don't think that this declaration of national defense significance is the reason we're being asked to leave. We believe that the use of the land for tourist development by Mr. Tien's daughter's company is the real reason.
I noticed there's been a lot of media coverage in the wake of this eviction notice. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, it's been really wonderful. We've been working both within Vietnam and without to contact media far and wide and get them to run this story and help bring attention to the issue. And just in the last few weeks here in the West, we've had the Vancouver Sun, the Washington Post, the New York Times blog, USA Today, all cover the story. CNN International has covered it. But probably more importantly, we're seeing the story start to really take hold in Vietnam itself, with Vietnamese papers and social media sites picking the story up and running with it. And in fact, just recently, the official Vietnamese government news source put out a story about this issue, which was quite exciting for us to see. Along with the media attention, we've received lots of help from politicians, from government officials around the world, several embassies in Hanoi, the American embassy, the Italian embassy, the British embassy, Australian embassies. They've all written letters in our behalf to the Prime Minister.
How about the Canadian embassy?
Not the Canadian embassy yet, as far as I know, but hopefully that will happen. And we've also had the European ministers and many, many other NGOs from around the world become involved in this issue, which is just fantastic. And what we're asking people to do around the world is to help also by writing a letter or sending an email to the Prime Minister of Vietnam, asking him to uphold the original agreement to allow us to build our sanctuary and maintain our sanctuary in Tam Dao. And there's information for that on our website at animalsasia.org/stop-the-eviction.
I've actually been to the Animals Asia website, and I did do the action items that were requested and suggested, such as writing to the Vietnamese authorities. However, I hadn't really thought much about the social networking aspect of things, apart from, say, sharing information on my Facebook page. Are there any other avenues in the sort of social media universe that we could be directing our efforts towards?
Well, actually, Facebook is the best place right now. In addition to the various petition websites, we have a petition on our website. There is a petition on change.org. There's also going to be one, hopefully, on a few other major petition sites, and that's a great place to do this. In terms of social media in Vietnam, if you write in Vietnamese and can kind of ferret out some of the Vietnamese social media sites, that's a great option. But we do have a full PR team in Vietnam working on this and sort of harnessing the energy of people throughout Vietnam that really love the bears, love this project, and want to make sure that it continues.
So now, of course, I have to ask the difficult question that must be on everybody's mind, which is, do you really think that you have a chance to win this thing? Do you think that there's a chance that the eviction notice will be retracted?
We think we're going to win. We really do. Yeah, we actually really do. It's such an obvious case of one person basically using undue influence over one government agency to create a real problem for a project that's already been ordained by the Prime Minister and has had always had government support. And we think that the Prime Minister will understand this and will know that not protecting the agreement with Animals Asia will also send a message to investors and nonprofits around the world that Vietnam might be not the right place to do work, not be the right place to do business. So we think that it would be wise for the Prime Minister to uphold the agreement that was originally made with us.
We're just about at the halfway point for the show, but before the break, here's some music from Kevin Tillman of the Vegan Hip Hop Movement.
This week's soundscape comes from Illuminati Congo, a Chicago-based hip-hop group. Vocalist John the Baptist and producer Nick the Graduate create an infectious blend of head-nodding beats and unexpected subject matter that will have you begging for a rewind. You can learn more about Illuminati Congo and other vegan hip-hop artists on the Vegan Hip-Hop Movement Blogspot, Facebook, and MySpace pages.
We keep it natural over here. We keep it organic over here. Got the best stuff on the planet over here. We have to keep it natural over here. We keep it live over here. We keep nature thriving over here. You know nature is our God, we surviving over here. Natural, we keep it live over here.
In my kitchen, I'm like a city chemist. Got the freshest herbs and juice of lemon. When ginger enters the picture, it clears congestion and energizes my endocrine system. There's only healings, there ain't no sickness. Just begin to listen to the body's symptoms. I sip ginseng, I suggest you get some. Anything can be cured naturally, no question. Cayenne peppers pep up the circulation. Get some tonic and bitters and some purification. Plant some seeds, see the germination. Like George Carver talking to the peanut plant naked. Breathing smoke of copal, frankincense and myrrh. Put my mortar and pestle, I'm making a cure. Mother Nature's elixirs and tinctures. Make sure everyone can be healed, safe and secure. Word.
We keep it natural over here. We keep it organic over here. Got the best stuff on the planet over here. We have to keep it natural over here. We keep it live over here. We keep nature thriving over here.
True
nature is our God, we surviving over here.
Yeah.
Natural, yeah. We keep it live over here.
It's no scary diseases that y'all gon' carry. To me, I use cloves and plenty rosemary. And cinnamons, peppermints grown on my own prairie. With a little house surrounded by wild berries. Strawberries, mulberries, gooseberries, raspberries, blueberries, juicy cherries, beets and carrots. It's a feast worth sharing. Let your food be medicine instead of eating careless. Alfalfa, olive leaf, and aloe veras. Ocean root, sage bush from the Los Sierras. Agave, yerba mate, yerba buena, yerba santa, and palo santo, lemon verbena. Border cola, ginkgo, go well together to increase brain power and help one remember. Cow and maca, black pepper, coriander, allow Mother Nature's healings for an answer.
We keep it natural over here. We keep it organic over here. Got the best stuff on the planet over here. We have to keep it natural over here. We keep it live over here. We keep nature thriving over here. Nature is our God, we surviving over here. Natural, we keep it live over here.
Now, it is crucial that advocates of animal rights take intersectional approaches to liberation. In this interview with Jennifer Cox, Catherine discusses some of the connections between queer, feminist, and animal liberation, particularly in terms of autonomy and reproductive rights. Here's the clip.
I'm wondering if you can actually kind of spell it out for us. In what ways is animal liberation a feminist issue?
Well, I think that there are a variety of ways. And since I've become more interested in, have been able to talk more nuanced about reproductive justice, I really feel like those are the strongest connections to animal liberation, animal rights. But I think my first clues were what Carol Adams calls an absent referent in mass terms. You know, so the ways that we describe animals that reduce their agency, that remove their individuality. So like calling animals meat and food, and by various descriptive names that describe their body parts, is mirrored in a lot of ways the ways that we describe women and those who are oppressed in terms of gender. And so the language that we use to describe both animals and women, that was my initial and first kind of perspective on that. And then I think that there are other things that are really important as well. Like, I remember taking a global politics class in my women's and gender studies program as an undergrad and talking about food access for women. And so talking about differences in food access and how agricultural subsidies really distort in the United States what food looks like, especially in terms of the availability of food that comes from animals, and that the majority of the world that's really seen as like a luxury, and that women are denied that luxury. And so, you know, we can deconstruct what that means in terms of the way we label animals, but it was obvious to me that women are sometimes forced by necessity to live on uncertain diets because of their relative position. And then I think other issues that connect gender and animal liberation, or I guess it's just at the most basic level, is that women and non-humans are oppressed for the same reasons, and that is for exploitation and use by people who benefit from patriarchy. And so men doing a lot of the raising of animals for food and animal agriculture, that do a lot of constructing society based off of their needs. And so using the earth, using women, and using animals for their disposable purposes and constructing them as commodities rather than as sentient beings.
So I'm realizing we should probably talk about what feminism actually means. What does it mean to you, and what's the perspective that you're coming from?
I think that a lot of people, when you ask them what feminism means, would probably say that, you know, it means equality for all people. And I think that equality, much like a welfare-based framework in terms of animal rights is, and even rights, is quite limited. And that if, you know, you asked me what I thought about what feminism means, I would argue that it is freedom from gender oppression, liberation from gender oppression, and looking at specific ways that manifests itself in different societies, in different regions, in different cultures. So I would argue that in any way that someone is oppressed by their gender is a site where feminism is needed. And that comes from the writing and the thinking that we do about this reality, and so theory, and then using that to help us brainstorm best options in terms of activism. So feminism is not just activism, it's also the theory, the literature, the scholarship that's behind it too. And then both of those working together in feedback to generate the best ideas and then the best plans for how to move forward.
I have to say that I really appreciate what you're saying about moving forward and having conversations that push us forward and help us recognize those connections. And I couldn't help but notice that if you look on the becausewemust.org website, you can see writer introductions. And in your introduction, there's a very serious effort on your part to recognize your privileges. And that's sort of your, I guess I see that as your point of departure. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the possibilities for progressive social change that might just come from that very act of recognizing our privileges and situating ourselves.
Right. I mean, especially because if you consider yourself an animal rights or animal liberation activist or an advocate or someone who cares about this, I think that the most important thing that really kind of just shocked me when I realized this was that of all liberation movements, this is the one where the beings needing liberation can't speak for themselves or don't speak for themselves, and so require others to do it for them. And it's really unique in that way, and it gives us more of an obligation, I think, to understand where we're coming from. So whenever I, you know, was kind of a growing feminist, but when I was really starting to feel comfortable using that label, you know, I would think about things that oppressed me personally, you know, like what affected me personally in terms of how I felt oppressed because of my gender and the way society treated me and others treated me were not the same for everyone. And that took kind of a rude awakening at times, you know, like butting up against other people and being forced to consider other people's perspectives, for people to call you out and say that, you know, you do not speak for everyone, you don't represent everyone, or these issues are more complicated than you think they are. And I just tried to really not get defensive and just listen to that, and made me realize that whenever I speak, I am speaking from a culmination of the experiences that have led me to this point. And I've only had certain experiences because, or not because, of certain privileges that have been afforded to me by no choice or earning of my own. And so constantly remembering that humility, I think, is what makes it easier for me to talk to a lot of different kinds of people and a variety of people about the issues that I am passionate about, care most about. Considering those perspectives makes it a lot more likely that people will listen to you, especially if you can consider on a really deep and authentic level, like where people are coming from and how to best respect them whenever you're trying to have a conversation about the way we want things to change. So
I wanted to ask you, Jen, in your biography on the Because We Must website, you say that you call yourself bisexual as an erotic and political commitment. I'm wondering if you can tell listeners what you mean by that.
Right, sure. I think it's really interesting, like when we were writing the kind of the anchor pieces for the website, Jeff had asked me if I would write the piece on queer, and so I wrote that, and he thought it was a typo when I said that queer could be a choice, and he helped me, and a couple of the people did too, and so I explained and defended how I described this in this way, and that, you know, as a bisexual person, and I've been out for a couple of years now, you know, as someone who's dated people who are male identified in the past, other people assume I'm straight, and it would be pretty easy for me to just kind of continue with that assumption, let other people think that and not challenge them or correct them, I guess, whenever they say that about me. The queer activists in Norman, in my community where I live, did a lot to transform my thinking about this. And when we're talking about passing privilege of bisexuals and talking about how, you know, they can, you know, likely be seen with a partner in public and, you know, not face any problems from other people and what that meant. And then, you know, one of my friends really encouraged me. She said, you know, if you want people to take bisexual concerns seriously, then you need to be out like all the time and you need to be unapologetic about it. And I thought she was totally right. And so I call myself bisexual and, you know, refer to myself as such and bring it up a lot because I have a political commitment to my own visibility and to visibility of other bisexual people. Because I think it, you know, in terms of queer, can be easy to fall to the wayside or not be acknowledged or, you know, for whatever reason. And I think that queer works the same, similar way too, that a lot of people can kind of quote unquote live quietly as we are. And that's not really possible for a lot of people, and I think not really politically advantageous to live quietly either. And so if we want liberation for people based on sexuality and gender identity and all those things, that for at least some people who feel like it's safe to can live openly and make political commitments to their own visibility and their own liberation. So that's kind of where that comes from.
Are there ways in which queer politics and animal liberation politics inform each other then, as far as, you know, having your body stand in as representing a political commitment?
Right. I think that there are a lot of connections between queer liberation and animal liberation. And that's part of the reason why I agreed to write this, because it was, I really wanted a place to kind of put those thoughts. I think that one of the biggest things, and I'm going to, you know, write about them specifically later, it's one of my kind of bigger research projects for Because We Must, is talking about the ways in which people, because of their sexuality or because of their gender identity or both, are subjugated by, you know, a white racist heteropatriarchy that would keep all of this kind of under the table. And so I can maybe even exist in the society as long as I don't name myself as such, as long as I don't call myself queer and live, you know, like whatever people say, like in your face or whatever. That I feel like a similar thing goes for animal liberation, that as long as it's under the radar and we don't talk about the beings behind the meat on your plate, then, you know, we just won't think about it, won't talk about it. One of the specific things that I'm going to do research on is connections in terms of vivisection between queer people and animals that, you know, in at least the United States history, and maybe even currently, I'm still doing the research to figure this out, but we're subject to medical testing and medical research against their will, and we're seen and constructed as less than humans so that they could do research upon them. And so people were given, you know, really extreme surgical and medical cures or whatever for their deviant sexuality or their deviant gender presentation. And so we're given electroshock therapy and different kinds of drugs and like surgeries, like lobotomies, like frontal lobe lobotomies, to get people to act straight, to act normal, quote unquote normal. And so I think that there are several connections that can be made between the ways that the medical establishment has oppressed people against their will, oppressed beings against their will, for the sake of medical research and for the sake of constructing, you know, a speciesist and heterosexist world.
Twyla Francois is a big name in the animal rights movement due to all of her undercover investigations and videos. That's why I was so delighted to have her on the show to talk about her recent expose as part of Mercy for Animals' foray into the Manitoba pig farm industry and pig slaughter in particular. Up next, we have this interview with Twyla Francois from Mercy for Animals. You mentioned at one point that, you know, public opinion of farm animals is essentially nothing compared to that of cats and dogs. How do you think exposés such as the recent, you know, pig farm in Manitoba, or documentaries, or, you know, various examples like that might change this?
Yeah, I think that probably one thing that, you know, industry is always claiming that we now have an urbanized population, they don't know anything about what's going on in farming, but they use that to their advantage as well. The fact that the public doesn't know that pigs have the intelligence of a three-year-old or can solve puzzles faster than dogs can. They don't know that chickens mourn their dead and develop strong bonds with one another and talk to their chicks even while they're still in the egg. And I think that these exposés help bring about that consciousness to see that, wow, these animals really are very much like dogs and cats. You know, they have nervous systems very much like us, very much like our dogs and cats, and therefore should have the same kind of protection. And that really hit me when I was reviewing the footage from our investigator. There was one pig in particular, 21401 was her ear tag number, and she was so dog-like. She was still a gilt, so she hadn't yet come into heat and hadn't yet been impregnated. So she was in a group pen type situation, so she was able to move a little bit. And whenever the investigator would come by, he would whistle for her, and she would come running, like literally trotting over with her ears flapping and her tail wagging, just like a puppy. And he would play with her and sort of roughhouse with her, and she'd run circles around him and put her, you know, her hooves down like a dog would the play stance. And they developed a really strong relationship. And partway through the investigation, the manager of the facility decided that they didn't want her anymore, that she hadn't come into heat fast enough, and so there was no use in trying to impregnate her, they just decided to kill her. And so she was loaded with a number of other pigs. Electric prods were used. She was hit in the face with a board. She was prodded onto the trailers, and the footage shows her going up with these other pigs and the door closing behind her. And she went off to slaughter. And where most of these pigs are going to slaughter is probably the second saddest part of their story. They are some of the most health-compromised animals in Canada, but because we don't have slaughterhouses that are set up for uneven sizes of animals. So, you know, they can be anywhere from 500 pounds to 800 pounds. So they go to wherever the oldest slaughterhouses exist, and most of them are in the Midwest U.S. So Iowa, Nebraska, and Ohio, Wisconsin. And so they've got these very long journeys, and there's no anti-dragging legislation in the U.S. So downers and, you know, animals that can't stand on their own, they're so sick, they're vomiting, they've got broken limbs, broken pelvises, they are shipped down there, and they're pushed, pulled, dragged, and electrically prodded off of the trailers. So that was very likely her fate in the end as well.
That's so heartbreaking, and I mean, to go from that almost sense of, like, childlike innocence, it's sort of what you reminded me of, and when she was coming when called and stuff, and just to go to such a brutal and violent fate. I'm guessing, do you ever, you know, when you or this investigator, did you ever get the urge to just steal them away?
Definitely. And I was able to sometimes. Generally, if I made if I was at a livestock auction, which are publicly attended, if I made enough of a fuss about an animal, you know, saying, well, this animal has a, you know, a broken leg, you know, who's going to want to buy it, you know, then they would generally just give the animal to me and just hope that I would just go away with them. And it was through those, though. I rescued a pig off the side of a highway after a trailer accident. Two turkeys I was able to rescue that they were Granny's turkeys. Granny's is a big turkey company here in Manitoba. And these two had escaped the brutal catchers that are hired to go in and grab them by their wings, heads, legs, whatever, and throw them into transport crates. So I was able to get two of those, and there's been a number of chickens as well. But what was interesting was all of them I brought back home, and I raised them like cats and dogs, and, you know, except like the horses and the pigs were, the pig was outside, and I had a large barn and straw and everything and 5 acres to run on. But what was just heartbreaking in a lot of senses was learning about them and learning their personalities, and that there is so much to each of these beings that even I didn't know about before I had them. So it almost makes it harder, actually, you know, after I rescued Wilbur the pig, then suddenly every pig investigation that I would do, when I go in and see thousands of Wilbers looking back at me, and knowing that each one of them was just as individual, and each one had favorite foods and favorite other animals to hang around with, and yet here they were kept in this squalor and filth, it makes it actually harder to keep going in and seeing these things, and I wish we could rescue them all.
And I just want to say, I really admire your strength, especially in terms of, you know, how you do these investigations, and you film this really important footage and bring it to the world to see, and I bet it really does, you know, bring the conditions these animals are raised in to light for a lot of people. How do you, like, do you ever get, you know, well, you mentioned how, you know, you get kind of bummed. You know, how do you deal with that burnout feeling?
For me, it is telling the story of those animals. So, you know, 21401, the pig in this investigation, the fact that we were able to tell her story and others like her. And these animals, I think people, when they think about this issue, you know, we're talking about 700 million farm animals in Canada, and it's just too difficult to wrap your head around. But if people can connect with one animal, that is the doorway for them to suddenly start to recognize the worth of all of these animals. And so for me, telling individual stories and doing the paintings, I try to paint out my feelings and then try to get some exposure to the paintings, because art is a really smart advocacy tool as well. People come to it without their guard up. Whereas, you know, if you approach someone with a book or a movie or a video or something, you know, everybody puts their guard up and puts on their protective shield because they know that it's going to be horrific. But artwork is something that everybody approaches sort of subjectively and without any preconceived notions. And then as they look at the piece, you know, I tend to do things from left to right of how I want people to look at the painting, because this is how Westerners read. And so, you know, the on the left, they'll see this animal, you know, looking quite healthy and happy. And then as their eye continues across the page, they see the shadow that the animal is casting, and it's a dead body on a hook. And that sort of forces them to think about, you know, hey, my natural inclination is to see these animals as individuals and healthy and happy, and yet this is the result of what's happening to them, and I'm supporting that by eating them. So, yeah, those are the ways that I cope.
Our last clip comes from Greg Benick, singer for the bands Trial and Between Earth and Sky. Greg is also a motivational speaker, and his humanitarian work, as well as his studies of life, death, suffering, and perseverance, are nothing short of inspiring.
That actually really reminds me, there's this one quote in your TED Talk from Puget Sound, just kind of talking about the link between art and activism, and you were talking before about, you know, the limitless potential, and one quote you said was, that really struck with me, was, "The artist continues regardless." From that, would you say that persistence would be the key to successful activism? Or what makes the artist such a good actor for creating and inspiring social change?
Yeah, well, and it's important. I think this is a great question. I think it's important to differentiate from the artist in, from a traditional sense, somebody who's painting, sculpting, singing, and somebody who is an artist, meaning somebody who is engaged in process, okay? And when I said that in the TEDx talk, specifically I was talking about the role of people engaged in process in life. And ultimately, the creative process is about going back and forth and back and forth and having tons of uncertainty. There's never a time in the work of an artist, and let's talk about the sort of traditional artist for a second, the sculptor, painter, singer, where you're coming up with lyrics and your first draft is perfect. Or you start carving, you know, the statue David in Italy, and the first draft is perfect. It doesn't work that way. The first 150 iterations of whatever you're imagining you might be able to create are absolute crap. They fall to pieces, they break, they sound stupid, and they look stupid. And then if you stay in that process, regardless of those failed attempts, then you come up with something, hopefully, that resonates. It doesn't have to be brilliant, it just hopefully resonates. So that process of staying in process, even when you feel completely confused and completely annihilated, that's what we're getting at here with this question. Because, you know, somebody who wants to create a sense of revolution, and again, revolution is defined countless ways by countless people, you're not going to come to the end point, because realistically, there probably isn't one. But you're not even going to come to the point that you want to get to right away. It's a process of trying, failing, meeting somebody. It doesn't work out. Communicating an issue, and you mess up what you're trying to say, and you sound like a complete moron. And then you keep going, and you keep going, and eventually the stars start to align, for lack of a better word, and you see that change, or that situation, or that status start to transform in the way that you envisioned it. It's the same way with writing lyrics, and I see it all the time. I stare at blank pieces of paper for far too much of my life, and then in time, all of a sudden, one line, another line, connections between a couple lines. I, you know, will present it to my bandmates, and they'll think, huh, this makes absolutely no sense. And I go, great. I delete the file, tear up the paper, go back, stare at a, you know, blank page for another couple weeks, and then come up with more. And then when I'm finally sincere with myself enough to really tap into some truths in myself, that's when all of a sudden things start to happen. And I think that the role of the revolutionary is to do the same thing. When one doubts his or herself, to stay in it, to stay in the process. And if the mission is sound, then the result will be there. It just isn't going to happen necessarily overnight or in any predetermined or any amount of time that could be calculated by any scientific method. It's very abstract. You just have to stay in it and step by step walk directly into the dark.
What would you say for those who perhaps haven't per se entered the process yet? I know you tell a story in the TEDx talk about how you had to cross a river after the tide had gone up and you were scared, but the most important thing was to take that first step. So how would you encourage people that might have passion to take that first step into transforming that into creativity and action?
Well, it's a great question, but I might even suggest, and this is my answer to you, is that the first moment of that experience of crossing that sort of deep water wasn't, I've got to dive in, I've got to go for it, or, you know, I have to get across this expanse of water and I've got to go step by step. The first moment was actually, me realizing, wow, I'm an idiot. I stood here on this island as the tide came back in, and I was so busy staring at the sky and imagining, you know, whatever was coming next in my life and where I was going to eat dinner and who I wanted to text and all this stuff, that I let the tide come in, and I was ready to be absorbed, swallowed, and swept out into the icy cold waters of British Columbia. So the first moment was, I'm an idiot, recognizing that and being sort of in touch with that sense of humility and having it be real, because I was standing there facing having to walk across this icy water that was going to be chest or who knows how deep, and then taking step by step into the water. And the reason I share that is because the question that I get asked all the time is, you know, okay, but what if I don't have a band? Or what if I'm not a good speaker? Or what if I don't exactly know what I want to do? Well, that's a great place to start. Like, form a band, practice speaking, and start trying a few things until you figure out what you want to do. That's a beautiful place to start. Like, you know, sitting back and saying at first, I'm clueless, or in my case, I'm an idiot, was a great place to start because, you know, it made me then accept the challenge of, okay, I'm not going to sit on this island overnight. I'm going to have to walk step by step and get out through the water, however I do it, unless, you know, a boat happens to come by or something, you know, the water goes away. But, you know, for people who are asking that question of themselves, that is the first step. The first step is that initiation, that inspiration of wanting to do something and not knowing how and not knowing why, and just, again, step by step, stepping foot into the dark. That's why the walking through the water is a cool metaphor, because you don't know what's coming next. You don't know if you're going to get swept away. You know, you're uncomfortable and scared, but you just keep going forward regardless. Well, it doesn't have to be that everybody who wants this has to walk through water in Canada in order to get to the other side with their laptop or whatever held high above their head as they're walking through this water. And I mean, I must have looked like a complete imbecile while I was doing this. Like, it's this great majestic story that, you know, I can tell in front of an audience and people get excited about it now. But realistically, if you watch me do this, you'd think to yourself, any Canadian would look at me and think, A, that guy's got to be American, and B, he's an idiot. But the key is that you enter into the process and you stay in it. And it starts from a place of not knowing what to do. That's a perfectly valid place to start. That's my point, is that you don't have to envision the Mona Lisa when you put paint on canvas for the first time. You could just say, I want to paint, or I want to do something, and just start. And I mean, who knows? Maybe you'll come up with a Mona Lisa. I mean, you know, you don't have to be a brilliant artist historically in order to create works of brilliance.
That's all the time we have for today. I just want to say a big thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in for the past year. I've loved bringing these interviews to you, and I hope you've enjoyed hearing them. Of course, I could not have done it without our team, Aaron O'Sullivan, Neil Harvey, Kevin Tillman, Taylor Book, Catherine Brigantino, and Lauren Corman. I wish you all the best in the new year, and I am delighted to keep bringing you more animal voices. I'm Daniel Angernon, and I hope you have a great day.